You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to another fantastic episode of Around the Block. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Susan Giddings, bringing you the latest and the greatest on BOP, FSA, SCA, court cases,
everything,
sentencing guidelines, stuff that may be imminent, not just hearsay, stuff. All right.
Yeah. So, you know, last week's show, we talked about several recent cases. A number of them had activity either decided in April or had recent activity in April. Well, you know, no sooner than we do a show about recent cases and it's in the book, so to speak, another one comes out. And we thought it was really important. And when Bruce and I were talking about to talk to all of you about this case, because there is there is information coming out that suggests like, oh, this is a done deal, everything's great, and this is going to open up programming in county jails to FSA credit. So it's not. I mean, the First Circuit Court seemed to think it does. In reading the circuit court's decision more than one time and digging into their rationale and cross-referencing it against the law, I really don't know how the First Circuit came to those conclusions. We'll just go with doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And let's talk about the statute and the law itself and the case itself. So this particular case is interesting because if you remember last week, we talked about two cases. One was Benson versus Warden out of the Fourth Circuit. And that particular case, this district court actually decided in the Bureau's favor. But the case actually was decided before Chevron was overturned. And so the Fourth Circuit kicked it back and said, hey, reevaluate not using Chevron. Because, of course, the Supreme Court overturned Chevron with the Loper-Bright decision. So they sent it back for them to evaluate. And in this particular case, let me take my glasses off so I can read for a second here. The individual was arguing that he had, in fact, completed programming before his risk need assessment was completed, and therefore he should receive credit. I believe, let me just double check my notes here. He was sitting in a county jail and was participating in programming. In the other case we talked about, so that one went to the Fourth Circuit. Fourth Circuit did not rule on the merits of it, but ruled on the jurisprudence that the court used, using Chevron versus Loper-Bright. So we have that one. So that one's still in the loop. But again, the original court case was decided in the Bureau's favor. The incarcerated individual appealed the case. Second case, this one out of the Seventh Circuit. Mm-hmm. Yes, the Seventh Circuit. This individual, and what makes this individual situation interesting was that he, Mr. Stark, who is the petitioner in this case, is similar to Mr. Miles in that he had what's called a concurrent overlapping sentence. And we'll talk about that in a second, just so we understand where everyone's coming from. But essentially, he was prosecuted on one sentence and remained in Marshall's custody for a period of several months while he was prosecuted on the second sentence and then got to the Bureau. So he had a period of time, and would you know, I did not highlight it, but he had a period of time where he was wanting to get some additional credit. But again, it had to do with he wanting to receive credit for programming earned prior to his FSA assessment. So before we jump into that, let's just cover a couple of things. First off, when it comes to pre-arrival custody, so custody where you are in custody but have not arrived at your designated facility. Why does the Bureau separate pre-arrival custody from initial designation? Because when you're in pre-arrival custody, technically,
you're a U.S. Marshal's prisoner.
You're a U.S. Marshal prisoner. You are not a Bureau prisoner, even if you are sitting in a BOP detention center. Now, do individuals sitting in a detention center have a stronger case for, hey, I'm programming and I'm doing Bureau programs? We can concede that. And there's some ways, there are some ways that perhaps logically within the context of the law, those can be at some point looked at, right? But there's also this other group of individuals that are sitting in county jails across the country. There may be programming. There may not be. The programming may possibly be an EBBR programming, or it may not be an EBBR programming. You know, for those who aren't, who haven't read the book, because we talk about what EBBR programming is, evidence-based recidivism reducing programs are programs for which they have been evaluated and they have found that individuals who successfully complete this programming have a lower risk of recidivating than similarly situated inmates who do not.
Right.
So one of the EBBR programs that the Bureau has is UNICOR. UNICOR Prison Industries is documented via research and shows that individuals who participate in prison industry programs are less likely to recidivate. And in fact, every dollar that is put into that particular program saves the taxpayers several dollars in future prosecutions and future incarcerations, future victimization, because it is a really good program. Those are one of the only work programs. I'll say apprenticeship programs, DOL apprenticeship programs, Department of Labor apprenticeship programs, some vocational tech programs as well. But in terms of just work assignments, prison industry is really the only documented program that has this result. And the reason is it is as close to real work environment as you get in prison. This is not an orderly job where you spend a couple of hours cleaning up in the housing unit, you know, and then maybe a couple hours after lunch cleaning up in the housing unit, not besmirching janitorial work. Janitorial work is important.
Or food service.
But if you're in food service in a structured Department of Labor apprenticeship program, that's different than you're assigned to food service and you sit at the table between meals and rolling napkins or whatever the case is, right? So when you look at a program, is it an EBBR is based on the research and that connection to its benefit with an incarcerated population, specifically on recidivism reduction. Okay, that's what an EBBR is. Productive activities, the two types of programs that have been identified in the law, are, again, structured programs and activities that are for either individuals or on a group basis, right, that are good programs, may have research that supports that they are good quality learning programs. They just may not have been tested or evaluated against an incarcerated population and the question of reducing recidivism. So a great example of that is two of the productive activities are a program called Money Smart and Money Smart for Older Adults. Bureau has had Money Smart in the institution for decades, I think. Money Smart is an FDIC program. It is developed to increase financial literacy for anybody. Anyone can go to the FDIC website, locate the program. You can have your teenage child taking it, your college age kid who needs to develop some financial literacy. This is not just a program that's good for inmates. It's good for everybody. And it's not necessarily connected to recidivism reduction, but it's still a solid, structured, good program. Okay. So those are the two types of programs we're dealing with. So that's EBBR and productive activities. So there is zero, no way the Bureau can track every single program that might or activity or something out there in every county jail in the United States. Or let me back up, every county jail that has a marshal's contract. They're not in marshal's custody. Now, the interesting situation, which parallels the Stark case, I believe, is this notion of concurrent overlapping. So the Bureau designates an individual when they receive a request from the marshals to designate them. Okay. In the case of someone who is facing prosecution, maybe in two districts, maybe, you know, if we think about like Bristol, Tennessee, splits the line between Tennessee and Virginia, Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri. Or maybe a person was on a little bit of a traveling venue and was in two different districts. Fort Worth or the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex area is interesting because you have some parts of the Eastern District, right, that kind of oddly mixed very close to the Northern District of Texas. So if you commit, if you're held and you're charged in two different districts, like the Northern District and the Eastern District, you get prosecuted in the Northern District. Well, the U.S. Marshals aren't going to send you to the Bureau and then come back and get you, take you to the Eastern District. They're going to hold you, and then you're going to go over to the Eastern District, and you're going to get prosecuted, right? So what happens in those situations is the individual has been sentenced on one case, right? We know anything prior, any incarceration prior to the first sentence is pretrial, and that doesn't apply. Now, they're kept in marshal custody, and they're sent to another court for a second prosecution. Now we have, and that second prosecution may be run concurrently, and in that case, it's their concurrent overlapping sentences could be run consecutively, okay? But regardless, the marshals aren't going to notify the Bureau and request designation until the second sentence is heard. Which means from the Bureau perspective, and in reality, let me say that. In reality, if you are sitting in a county jail under marshal control, under marshal custody, you get prosecuted for one case, you get transported to a second court for a second prosecution, the Bureau has no idea you exist. The Bureau doesn't know you exist for individuals in county jails unless the marshal makes that request to designate. And when they do, they provide the Bureau with the pre-sentence investigation report, a judgment and commitment order, statement of reasons, and then there is another document called Marshal 129, and that just gives the Bureau information about when you were in custody, were you bonded out, were you not bonded out, were you writted to the state. It just gives them information about your time with the marshals in terms of in and out of custody. Okay. So in this First Circuit court case, boy, that's a mouthful, Miles versus Bowers, it was just decided on the 27th. Okay. So that was the situation for this individual. He was being held in marshal custody for like 15 months before he sets foot in Bureau custody. The Bureau has no and doesn't get, won't even know about this guy. I don't know for this for certain because I'm not looking, I don't have his case notes, but I'm willing to put money on the marshals did not request designation and provide the judgments and the pre-sentence investigation reports until he was sentenced in both cases. Okay, So that's problem number one. He wasn't a marshal. He wasn't a bureau person. And until the second sentencing, the bureau likely has no information. Now, the court spends what I consider an inordinate and an erroneous amount of time focused on the fact that somehow the bureau controls the U.S. Marshals.
Right.
So, for example, notably, nope, that wasn't the right one. Wait a minute, I gotta find my, I'm actually highlighted. Here it is. Notwithstanding the Bureau's decision, the BOP's decision to leave him in Marion County for the ensuing 15 months, the Bureau does not control movement of a person to their initial designation. That is completely and totally handled by the U.S. Marshals. So for the court to clearly have a misunderstanding, and again, I don't know because I don't sit in the circuit court, and I have, I haven't asked the question. At least it wasn't an issue
because when
they
I was see working. The Marshals as a maybe the, they see the Marshals as a DOJ component.
No, I think they think the Bureau controls it, and if the person arguing. Doing the oral arguments was a Maine justice attorney because I'm assuming they were, a presuming, I don't know, but I'm presuming it was argued by a Department of Justice attorney who is not knowledgeable of how the Bureau works because I can't imagine any Bureau attorney like letting that go. The Bureau
DOJ
has,
it. Yeah.
Yeah, the Bureau has no control. Do I think a DOJ attorney wouldn't necessarily know internal operations and understand that relationship? 100%. There was another place in here that that there was more than one place. And in another place, they've made the statement, and I'm going to find this because I actually found it like – kind of comical in a sarcastic, obnoxious kind of way. Let's see. I made so many notes on this and highlighted in different colors, and it's kind of crazy. Okay. So in another place, to comply with this directive, and they're referring to the, again, we're talking about the completing the risk and need assessment. The BOP cannot choose to house prisoners outside a federal facility or an interim federal facility, again, even detention centers, right? Movement from the detention center to the initially designated facility, they are still a marshal's prisoner. Marshals are determining transportation. After the commencement of the sentence and then disregard the qualifying activities. So they're saying...
I also want to bring up the other issue of housing. Not only their transit, but their housing. And not all these marshals prisoners have the luxury or ability or whatever to go to one of our metropolitan detention centers or whatever. Man, they're sitting in such and such county jail where the marshals have contracted 6 beds, let's say.
Right. And they're stuck in the middle of nowhere. You know,
yeah. And yeah. And so to me, I'd folks, I'm just saying this for the folks out there to underscore that that's a whole different picture there.
Oh, 100%. And here's the interesting part. Now, okay. Hypothetically, you know, we talk about how the risk instrument, we talk about the different methods that are used, you know, we have some that are self-assessments, some that are document reviews using the pre-sentence investigation report. Some may have a hybrid of self-assessment or interview. There's different things, but several things the Bureau currently uses the pre-sentence investigation report as the tool, right? Substance abuse history. The initial assessment is based on the information in the pre-sentence investigation report, substance abuse history section. Easy peasy, right? So let's hypothetically say the Bureau goes, you know what? We are tired of getting beat up by courts that don't understand that there's a reason we pick the initially designated facility because of initial classification, which is when the Bureau has been reviewing PSRs, identifying needs, and assigning programmings for what, 5 decades, 6 decades? When did unit management start? I don't even know, the 70s, whatever the math is there, right? Late 70s is when unit management came in. So when, and we talk about this in the book. So unit management has been a core of correctional management, not just in the federal system, but in the state system, right? And state systems are different in that many states have one or more reception centers where individuals will go to the reception center. They go to practically right from court. They go through all of these assessments, reviews, et cetera, security, classification, and then they're sent out to the appropriate facilities. The Bureau doesn't do that. Many years ago, the Bureau established the DSCC, the Designation Sentence Computation Center, to centralize classification as well as sentence comps. Prior to that, classification and designation, initial classification and designation was handled in the 6 regional offices, while computation was handled, sentence computations were handled at the local facility. So they consolidated that. That acts as kind of a quasi reception, except it's not an in-person reception center, right? We get the documents and the Bureau does these reviews. What are the kind of things they review? They identify information from the PSR to assign security level, which dictates level of prison. They review the pre-sentence investigation report for mental health and medical needs. They assign a screen level, right? A preliminary medical care, not care level, medical screen level, which parallels the care levels that are later given, right? So they do this preliminary document analysis and says, hey, you look like you're healthy, or hey, you don't look so healthy. And they assign a screen level. And then when the person gets to the institution, they're then reevaluated in person, right? We also use the, so we have security level, we have the screening level for medical and mental health. We also have intel people who are doing what? They're reviewing for things like disruptive group, gang membership, other security concerns, things that might warrant elevating a person's security level. So it's not part of the classification, but it's an additional screening, right? If you're validated and as certain as a member of certain gangs, you're going to be put in a higher secure facility. Guess what else is there? You got psychologists that are evaluating and reviewing PSRs because it may be appropriate to send this individual to a facility with an RDAP program because maybe they're right at a 36-month sentence, 38, 40-month sentence. They have a substance abuse need. The judge has recommended treatment. It's clearly documented without even talking to the person. We know they qualify for the residential drug abuse program. So the Bureau then smartly sends them to an institution that matches their security level, their custody level, their medical and mental health needs, and has an RDAP program if bed space is available, right? Rather than sending them one place and then transferring them. So they're one already... Go ahead.
Oh, we had that one guy. It wasn't an initial thing, but he was in Terminal Island area, and then he ended up going to Duluth or whatever.
And why was that? Because they didn't have an RDAP program. RDAP program got shut down. They didn't have an RDAP program at that security level near where he was. That was a bad situation. They could have picked several other. And again, it comes down to that point, it comes down to bed space, right?
Like booking a hotel.
Right. But the psychology staff at DSCC also evaluate other things. They look at initial sex offender treatment designations. We already talked about RDAP. So let's hypothetically say the Bureau says, gosh, golly, we are tired of being beat up over this initial classification. Even though we've been doing it for 15 freaking years, nobody understands it. The law was written poorly and we're just getting beat up. Nobody wants to listen to us. Okay, we're just going to throw up our hands and we're going to shift the, as much of the FSA needs assessment using just the pre-sentence investigation report. Could we do that? There's a lot of information that we can get from a pre-sentence investigation report. And the better the pre-sentence investigation report, the more information the Bureau has. And as an initial, right, this is an initial risk assessment. So, and I'm going to use an example. I'm going to pick on trauma needs, right? The Bureau, as the process, uses the ACEs assessment, which is an assessment of childhood trauma. And then in addition to multiple questions from the ACEs to assess childhood trauma, because oddly enough, I know this is shocking, someone who experiences a lot of trauma and violence as a child is at higher risk for getting in trouble and encountering law enforcement in the criminal justice system. I sarcastically say, surprisingly, but you know, you've done it. You've looked at a PSR and you're like, shocked it took the person until they were 27 to end up in federal prison because they came from a screwed up background. But guess what? The pre-sentence investigation report gives us family social history. You will read PSRs that say this person was born of this person, and their father died by drug overdose or suicide, or they have two siblings in prison, or they report being physically abused by a father and the mother confirms that, you know, or there's other narrative information that supports this person experienced childhood trauma or trauma as an adult. You know, the Bureau uses the ACEs, and then there's an additional question or two in terms of adult trauma, right? Can we use a PSR to capture, at least at an initial level, maybe not to the point of saying, you know what, you need in this kind of more intensive therapy, whatever we choose, right? But if you look at what the Bureau does now, there is a preliminary trauma assessment using the ACEs. You are entered into a kind of entry-level trauma program. At the end of that program, you are then reassessed. And if, in fact, the level of trauma you experience requires more, you're going to be recommended for a more intensive program. Similarly, substance abuse education. Substance abuse as a criminogenic need. But what we're doing the assessment that we use for substance abuse that's directly from the PSR means someone needs to take drug education. Drug education is drug education. It is not a treatment program, but it starts a person on the path, and then they receive further in-person interviews assessing their substance abuse history and use and whether non-residential or the RDAP program is appropriate. So, if we can do that for drug education, for trauma, we can look at the different risk needs assessments and make a decision at an intake level at DSCC. Now, does that put extra work on DSCC? 100%. Does that mean they might need to expand the staffing at DSCC? You know, they have the folks that load the information, that do the PSR review and load the information, and then they have the designators to take that information and make designation decisions. Do we maybe need to have more people putting eyes on PSRs to look at that? Okay, that's an answer, right? But here's the problem with that. So now this magical world, we've waved our magic wand, initial risk assessments, initial needs assessments are occurring as part of a structured pre-sentence investigation report review. Voila, magic. Now, the problem with that, not from the Bureau side, right? The Bureau is going to have their own issues in terms of implementation and more staffing and blah, 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 blah. So we'll put that aside for a second. For the individual sitting in martial custody, right? So they get sentenced, their documents are released from probation to the U.S. Marshals. The Marshals then release the documents to the Bureau, make a request for designation. The Bureau does this as part of their designation process, also does a risk assessment. Okay, now your risk assessment is complete. They can upload it into the system just like when they upload the designation information, and it can be available for individuals, the staff members, sitting in Bureau detention facilities. Chicago, Houston, New York, Los Angeles, San Diego, those detention facilities, right? What about the dude sitting in a county jail somewhere? We actually create a situation by moving the risk need assessment to the point of designation. You now create a situation of disparate treatment. Those that are in BOP facilities can have treatment, can start participating in programming. You know, the Bureau, you know, I know when I was retiring, they were starting, you know, the use of tablets was starting to roll out. I know just listening to some of the interviews, they're really looking at deploying tablets and having some of these programs kind of using hybrid models like our colleges do, right? Some classes are in person and you're sitting in a classroom. Some you're sitting at home and you're doing it on your computer.
Was that FDIC program, EBBR, whatever, the FDIC financials?
Oh, no, that's a productive activity, but it counts. It's still an FSA program.
Since that's in the public domain, even county jails could maybe have that.
Could.
And put it on their tablets.
If they did it. But again, in terms of disparate treatment, right? Mm-hmm. Inmates sitting in marshal custody, but sitting in a detention center, a Bureau detention center, has the ability to at least start programming. And the fella that's stuck in somewhere in the middle of the country in a county jail doesn't. The Bureau doesn't have access. There's not a link between those two. Now, let's come back to the Miles case. So those are the problems. Like, yes, can the Bureau change when they do the risk assessment or the needs assessment? I'm sorry. Yes, 100% they can. Is it going to be the day they get sentenced? No, it has to be in the earliest. Right. And this requires the Bureau to change a lot of things, right? But the earliest it can be accomplished is at designation, period, end of sentence. And for an individual like Miles, who had two convictions going on, two prosecutions going on, if the marshals don't provide the Bureau the information, he literally doesn't exist. If you were to run a person's reg number that's sitting in a county jail for which the marshals have not requested designation, and you run their number on the BOP website in the public site, it will literally come up no such inmate. Because the Bureau doesn't even create them in the system if they're sitting in a county jail until the Bureau, until the marshals provide the information. So now let's go back to Marshall, or back to Miles. So first off is the First Circuit is completely wrong in their assessment that somehow the Bureau is choosing not to move inmates or the Bureau has any control over them. They're just wrong. And that's all I can say for that. Now, the points that they tapped, that they focused on, there were four, and they were, I'm going to grab these here. The first was whether the Bureau may delay the accrual of FSA time credits until the person arrives at their designated facility, as its regulation provides. Now, this has been attacked from all sides, and it goes back to this fundamental misunderstanding that, yes, the law says commencement of sentence. The law also says, this I do have bookmarked, the law also says that a risk and need assessment shall provide guidance on the type, amount, and intensity of evidence-based recidivism reduction programming and productive activities that shall be assigned to each prisoner, including programs in which the Bureau of Prisons shall assign the prisoner to participate according to the prisoner's specific criminogenic need. Now, a simple and plain reading of that, contrary to what the First Circuit said, literally creates a sequential set of activities. The Bureau has to assign based on the person's specific criminogenic needs. That means something that the inmate chooses to do on his own or is assigned to by a county jail official wanting him to stay busy is not the same as the Bureau of Prisons shall assign. That's pretty straightforward, pretty obvious language. What I find interesting is the First Circuit ignored this line. There was some focus that Miles, and I don't fault Miles for this, it was his case, he was looking. He says where the system provides guidance on the type, amount, and intensity, that doesn't say the Bureau has to rely on that, or it has to be done first. Okay, that's just saying, hey, this system needs to be developed so that it's providing guidance to the Bureau. But the next sentence says that the Bureau of Prisons is assigning the programming, and they're assigning programming on the specifically identified criminogenic needs. In order to have specifically identified programming needs, the person has to have a risk assessment. So I just don't know where the first circuit like went off the rails on this decision. So the first one had to do with the delaying of the accrual of credits until they've been hit their designated facility. That is directly tied to when the risk need assessment is done, which is in within the first 28 days during their initial intake and initial classification. Okay, we've already said, okay, so the Bureau changes the whole system and starts doing this initial risk assessment that is strictly based on a document review. Okay, now it's being done at designation. Next, it says whether the FSA risk and need assessment is a prerequisite for the prisoner's entitlement to earn credit. Okay, so they sort of miss a step in here. As we talk about in the book, individuals are not earning credit directly, right? They are accruing programming days, which are then cashed in, so to speak, for the FSA credit. If they don't accrue the programming days, they don't get the credit. It is not like good conduct time, right? Where it's strictly a function of your sentence. You have a 36-month sentence, 54 times 3, that's 156, what's that? I've lost my count. Whatever it is. 54, yeah, whatever it is. I'm not mathing today. It's strictly a function of your sentence. FSA requires certain things to happen, right? Inmate is assessed. Bureau assigns programming. Inmate participates in programming. Inmate accumulates programming days. Inmate earns FSA days. It is a linear activity. Now, one of the things the court picked on was the fact that once someone is in custody, right, and they're in custody and they receive their risk and need assessment system, the Bureau allows them, as long as they agree and are willing to participate in programming and they're on that wait list, we allow them to accumulate programming days. The Bureau is not penalizing the incarcerated population because they don't have an open seat in the classroom. The inmate's going to take non-res because he has a substance abuse treatment need, but the non-res class starts at the first of the quarter, every quarter.
And as long as they're on the waiting list.
And he's on a waiting list. He's like, yep, I'm going to do it. You're right. I need this. And he goes on the waiting list and he gets to the next class. So the Bureau presumes good faith that you have agreed to participate in programming. We have you on the wait list. And when the seat opens up next quarter or next month or whatever it is, you're going to follow through and take the class. So we don't penalize you. Mind you, if it comes time for you to take the class and you're like, yeah, I changed my mind, you, that all that good faith programming days, right, that were accrued on the basis that you were going to get backed out of the system, right? They had heartburn with the wait list. Now, here's the comical part, sarcastically comical part. When the First Step Act was passed and the initial steps for implementation were happening, it happened during President Trump's first administration under Attorney General Barr. And as we talk about in the book, in those early days, implementation program participation was going to be based on one, program completion, meaning you didn't get the credit until you actually completed the program. And that's how we were going to define successful participation, was completion, successful completion. And two, you were only going to get credit, programming day credit, based on 8-hour programming days, which means the 500-hour residential drug abuse program is sick. When you divide that by 8, you get 62 and a half days. So under the original implementation, the original rules language that was developed and put out, a person would do a 9-month program. They would only get credit for the days for while they were participating and only if they successfully completed it. 62 and a half days of programming, depending on what time part of your sentence, that is worth 10 or, I'm sorry, that is worth 20 or 30 FTCs. Then, as we all know, elections have consequences. We had an election, we have a new administration, we have a new attorney general, and the Garland administration just turned everything up on its head. So now, if you're sitting in a wait list, you're getting credit for the wait list time, because it can't be the Bureau's fault that you were willing to take the program, they just didn't have a space available. That's on the Bureau, not on the individual. I appreciate that. But now you sit in a 9-month program, and maybe it took you 6 months to get into the program because RDAP cohorts, maybe twice a year they start those, you know? Mm-hmm. So depending on when you get in, you could be waiting anywhere from weeks to several months. So you're on a wait list for 6 months and then you take the program and you complete it in 9 months. Okay, so 6 plus 9, that's 15 months. 15. You're earning credit for that entire time. Mm-hmm. So the new earning architecture that was put in place under the Garland administration quite literally was done to afford individuals the time credit that this court is taking umbrage with. Well, you're not, you know, you're willing to give them credit for programming days for on the wait list. So what are you all so bent out of shape about whether the programming happens before or after the risk assessment? Like, quite literally, it is an asinine argument. It's insane.
That is
an asinine argument. Their theory is, their argument is, it doesn't matter when the risk and need assessment happens. If they took programming back here somewhere, right?
Retroactively, yeah.
Well, we can go, well, you took this or you took that. Okay. Maybe you could say that if they were in a GED class. GED is essentially the same wherever you go, right? It's a standardized test. Okay. You might even be able, if they were in some kind of non-residential substance abuse treatment, if you had, you know, if there was documentation provided. But remember, the entire system is built to be done automated in an automated way, Because why? Because the law is written in such a cumbersome and convoluted way that it can't be easily tracked or monitored without a lot of computers being involved and a lot of coding and being involved. So now we're not just saying the First Circuit is saying
5 minutes, yes. 5 minutes.
Oh my God. I was just so upset about this whole thing. It was just a crime. And the last point they looked at is whether he would be ineligible to earn credits for periods between the first and second sentencing because his sentencing had not yet commenced on the second for purposes of the second one. And again, the court totally doesn't understand. The Bureau never even knew about this individual prior to the designation. But what's really interesting is when you get down to it, and we talked about this yesterday, and we also talked about this during, last week, but we also talked about it in the op-eds that we did regarding the Bureau showing their work. At the end of the day, all this case did was told the Bureau, you got to show more work. And in the case of Miles, he did orderly work. Orderly work is not a productive activity EBBR under the FSA system. So even if we accept the First Circuit as, yep, you were right, which I'm saying they're not, but even if we accepted that, the only programming that would be acceptable is if XYZ County Jail had some
GED.
I could see GED, but beyond that, not really, because GED is pretty straightforward. You don't have an education. Right. It's in your PSR, but you still end up with this issue. The Bureau can make changes and for reasons I think make sense to have used this designation process, it would be much more efficient. It would be a huge change, but you get case managers focusing on casework and you use the DSCC folks who are already reviewing. That's their primary job. That is their job, is reviewing that PSR entering information. This is asking them to enter more information. But even if you do it, now you create this kind of dual system with those who were, you know, somehow managed to get themselves into a Bureau detention center versus being held in a county jail. I think it's completely illogical and impractical to say, well, they could just randomly take programming, and if it later turns out it's in a need area, then they can get credit, which is a little odd. But setting it aside, the oddness of it, it clearly says the Bureau has to be the one assigning the programs, and nothing a person does voluntarily. Oh, I just took programs. It didn't matter if it wasn't related to need, whether it's in the Bureau or in pretrial or in holdover status in a detention facility or sitting in a county jail. There is a sequential effort to this, and how the First Circuit missed that, I am like, baffled beyond belief. Baffled.
Crazy. Yeah.
Can you tell I'm irritated about this? Because it's putting out a lot of false hope. And there are some folks out there that put out some videos that have followers that are saying, oh gosh, this is wonderful, da da da. And the end of the day, all it's going to do is the Bureau is putting more work on the Bureau, which means taking more resources away from the population to program, because now if we have, whether it's case managers or psychologists or education folks having to run down information, according to the First Circuit, this is what the Bureau should do, run down information to see if this program in some county jail somehow matches infidelity to the programming that has already been approved and it's part of the program catalog. So we're going to waste resources. We're going to get people's hopes up. And at the end of the day, they've accomplished nothing. Totally irritated.
We'll see how that, on that note, we'll see how that plays out.
I'm a little incensed about it.
I can tell. Absolutely.
Like, what the hell is this? It was crazy when I was reading it.
Absolutely.
I was cussing aggressively while reading it to myself.
Oh my gosh.
So in other news, as we close out, I know we got just a minute. We got the book back from the manuscript back from the editor. We are fine doing the final editing. Very excited. We all goes well. There's some formatting and such. We'll have the paperback version uploaded to Amazon if all goes well within a few days, and then usually takes Amazon a week or so to turn it around. We'll do the soft copy first, and then we'll see how it works as an ebook. Some because of the graphs and charts and stuff, sometimes those don't work as well in ebook, but we'll take a look and see how it's going to work. But yeah, we could have it out within less than a couple of weeks, hopefully.
All right. Well, Christmas came early, and it's a Christmas colored book.
Yes, it is in a beautiful colonial red. Beautiful
colonial.
When we were talking about it, I'm like, yeah, you know, like a pretty deep red, like a colonial red. So.
All right. All right, folks. Well, we got to wrap it up here. Come by our Facebook group, Early Release from Federal Prison for Step Act. It's now a private group, so it's an extra step to get in. The Federal Prison Authority has a Facebook group that's public, and many of these shows are there. We also have a YouTube channel for Step Act, and we're on Apple Podcast, and you can also get all these great videos and MP3s here from LA Talk Radio as they are archived. So with that, we'll have everybody have a great week, and we'll see you here next week on Around the Block. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Bye. You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.